You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 4th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, nor are we in the heartland of America, although arguably. But instead, I am live at the Mass Torts Conference 2018 in Las Vegas, Nevada, sort of also the heartland of America, let's face it. The heartland is where you find it, ladies and gentlemen. On the program today, I'm going to be interviewing a series of attorneys who are working on issues ranging from wages to sex workers to Monsanto suits, opioid suits, and more. Also on the program, of course, the White House has found no corroboration of sexual misconduct allegations against Brett Kavanaugh because you cannot find what you do not seek. The FBI has delivered its so-called report to the Senate. The question is, will they be satisfied with a report that ignored literally dozens of people who wanted to testify and felt they had information that was pertinent to the investigation? We shall see if the Senate goes ahead with Brett Kavanaugh. In the meantime, Republicans are convinced that this Brett Kavanaugh fight is helping them by triggering the male aggrievement synapse in the brains of all Republicans. We'll talk more about that. Good news, a federal judge quashed, for the time being anyways, the Trump administration's attempt to end the temporary refuge system, TPS, for 300,000 immigrants in this country. We will talk more about that. And all this, and of course, more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I am here in Las Vegas for my biannual. Is that the way you put it?
Biennial.
Twice a year. You guys are back in the studio, correct?
Yeah, sure. We are. I said biennial, but you couldn't hear it.
Okay. Biennial. Trip to Las Vegas. I had a pretty good day at the tables yesterday. I'm not gonna brag, but let's just say six figures if you include the decimal points. So six figure win if you include like more decimal. Actually, yeah, maybe closer to five figure. Let's put it that way. If you include the decimal points, so it depends. A lot of. You do fractions of cents. Things look very, very good for me. We're here, and for those people who are new to the show, the reason why I do this show, why I come here, in part, it started when, in doing Ring of Fire Radio with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy years ago, Papantonio is a big tort lawyer, and particularly in an era where you have an assault on a regulatory state, tort lawyers are essentially the last firewall. They function sometimes as like the posse. We saw this in the context of the mortgage. To the extent that the government handed out any mortgage penalties, it was all built upon work that had been done by private attorneys in suing specific investment banks on behalf of, let's say, pensions or municipalities or whatnot. And then the AGs took that information. I'm going to be talking to someone in a moment about the opioid crisis and what attorneys are doing for that and contrasting it to the tobacco settlement. The tobacco settlement was actually Mike Papantonio's partner fashioned the biggest tobacco settlement in the country in Florida. And very often these are the guys who are filling the gaps in the regulatory state and holding them to account when it seems like no one else is. So let's get that started right now. Jeff, come have a seat. Joining me now is Jeff Gaddy. You're with the firm Levin Papantonio as well? Okay, let me just pop up your mic here. So, Jeff, just try and speak into that as much as you can. Jeff Gaddy, you're with the firm Levin Papantonio?
Best Call of Florida, yes.
And I need you to get a little bit closer. This is sort of like a deposition.
I gotcha.
Okay. So tell me the litigation you're working on now.
So I'm spending about 90% of my time working on the national opiate litigation based in Cleveland, Ohio, in front of Judge Polster. There are a bunch of different plaintiffs in the case, but the vast majority of the cases involve local governments, cities, and counties who have brought lawsuits against the manufacturers and distributors of opioids, alleging that those bad actors are primarily responsible for the harms of the opioid epidemic.
And so is it specifically, I mean, I've spoken to some folks from Levin Papantonio and some other firms who are working with you on this. Is it specifically the manufacturers, specifically the distributors?
It's both. And there's different theories against each respective group.
Let's start with the theories against the manufacturers, because I know a little bit about the distributor one, but the manufacturer.
Sure. So the manufacturer theory is essentially a false marketing, misbranding, false representations type case. Opioids is essentially morphine. Morphine's been around for centuries. It had always been known that morphine and the morphine equivalent, which is what you find in Oxycontin, Vicodin, all these other drugs, was highly addictive. And what happened is back in the 90s, early 90s, the pharmaceutical manufacturers figured out that if they could convince the medical community that these drugs were not addictive, that instead of the drugs being properly used for 2-3 day post-surgery type pain, cancer pain, if they could convince the medical community these drugs were not addictive, they could get doctors to write scripts for 30, 60, 90 days. And you can quickly imagine what that does to their bottom line.
And so what did they do to the products when they manufactured it? I mean, they just put like some type of coating on it that supposedly was time released. Is that the theory that they had? Like, I mean, when they showed up and said, oh, we have a new type of highly addictive substance, but this one's not. What's the story they told about that?
So sure, there's definitely a story there, and Purdue Pharma is the company that gets the most headlines and is kind of perceived as being one of the worst actors in this area. But they introduced OxyContin to the market in January of 1996, and from there was a history. Originally, the drug was immediate release. You take the pill and you immediately get the release of the narcotics into your body. There was very quickly a immediate rise in abuse, addiction, deaths from opioid overdoses. So
I remember Rush Limbaugh. I mean, not to point any fingers on any one person, but Limbaugh was in trouble for doctor shopping and going around taking out $9,999 that he's supposedly giving into his cleaning lady.
Sure. And so look, that's one of the things about this addiction is it is gender blind, racially blind, economically blind. Anybody can fall victim to this. But yeah, so over time, these companies started adding some of these coatings to the pills, advertising them as extended release drugs. Where those failed was users quickly found out they could simply crush the pills and get all of the high right away. What made that such a bad scenario is that by making them extended release, they made the pills more potent. And so now you have these pills out on the market, which, you know, before were smaller doses. Now you have the larger doses that the addicts very quickly figured out how to abuse those. And people who had become addicted from starting out on what they thought was maybe a prescription that they actually needed.
Okay, and so that's the theory for the manufacturer is that you mislabeled this. You said it was non-addictive. It was addictive.
Correct.
And the theory for the distributors, like the McKessons, what's the theory on the cases in regards to the distributors?
Sure. So ever since the Controlled Substance Act was written back in 1970, all distributors have had a duty to be on the lookout for to detect and report to the DEA any suspicious orders of opioids, and that term is defined within the statutes and regulations. Essentially, the way to just kind of boil it down to its basics is that the distributors had a duty to prevent the creation of pill mills. Obviously, they failed miserably. You know, the stories that have been widely publicized about the large number of pills going into small communities in West Virginia, in Kentucky, some of the outrageous stories from South Florida, some of the video that can be seen that's taken on cell phones of folks inside pill mill clinics where you have lines around the building with folks looking for pills. Those were the jobs of the distributors, was to be on the lookout for that activity. And they failed. And they've been caught failing. You know, McKesson's been fined multiple times for violations of this specific act. Walgreens, who most people think of as a pharmacy, all of these chain pharmacies have their own distributor wing. So Walgreens for a long time was supplying their own Schedule II drugs to themselves. Back in 2013, they paid an $80 million fine for specifically violating this act. So it's widespread bad behavior on their part.
So what is the relationship between what you guys now, you guys are representing towns and counties, municipalities and states?
So the vast majority of the cases that are pending in Cleveland, are on behalf of cities, towns and counties. There is one state that's in that litigation. That's the state of Alabama. They thought that one thing that's kind of unique about attorney generals is they never have to be in federal court. They can always file their cases in state court. Alabama decided that federal court in Cleveland was the best place for them to be. So the litigation that's proceeding there is primarily local governments. There are many state attorney generals who have brought their own claims in their own states. There's about an equal number that have not. So
you're bringing a federal claim.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You're bringing a federal claim. And all right. Well, so, and I want to get to a little bit more into your plaintiffs. And it's interesting that Alabama felt like we're not going to get a fair shake maybe with our own state judges because, I mean, am I interpreting that right?
I don't represent the state of Alabama. I certainly wasn't privy to the conversations that led to their decision to go into the MDL. So you can speculate as much as you like.
But, all right. All right. Let me ask you this then. If I was to speculate that the attorney general in a specific state wants to join a federal action instead of taking it at home, it's probably because they think that their judges are probably too predisposed to ruling in favor of the corporate interests.
Is that possible? Sure. I think the other thing that's also possible is they look at the opportunity to be a leader in the MDL, and they, you know, the Judge Polster has appointed them as one of the briefing track cases. So they've filed the motions to dismiss have been briefed in their case, and Alabama had the opportunity to respond for that, and it certainly put them in a position of prominence on a national basis, and as it relates to the litigation. So I can't say.
I was talking hypothetically.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
All right. Well, then. all right. With that said. So how is what you are doing different from the tobacco settlement? Characterize the tobacco settlement for us and then go into that. But before we do that, does the history of these companies, particularly the distributors, having paid fines, does that mitigate their culpability, or does that help you in having to say, like, well, I don't even have to prove that they broke the law, because the fact that they paid a fine is indication of that. I just need to prove that they actually caused damages because of those actions that they already copped to.
Yeah, it's definitely the latter. Those actions and those civil findings by administrative law judges they boost our case. What makes it even worse is there are multiple times where these companies were sanctioned by the government. McKesson back in 2007, again in 2016. So you have almost a decade's worth of conduct that did not change as a result of them getting paying a fine back in 2007. And they're not the only ones. So they boost our case because, A, they show notice to the company. They tell the company, hey, the DEA came in and said what you're doing is wrong, you're doing it the wrong way, and it's so serious that we're gonna financially penalize you for it. And what we've seen over and over again is the conduct did not get better.
Wow. Okay. All right. And so, yeah, explain to me, characterize the tobacco settlement and explain to me why this is different.
Sure. So we talked just a moment ago about attorney generals bringing cases versus the local governments, and the tobacco settlements were completely and totally driven by attorney generals. I mean, my firm was very involved in the tobacco litigation. Fred Levin was involved in writing the Medicaid Third Party Recovery Act in the state of Florida, which paved the way to allow attorney generals to bring those types of claims. So we've certainly done both. The difference is that the tobacco litigation was 100% driven by the AGs, and the money, for the most part, that was recovered in those litigations went directly to the state legislatures to be distributed as they saw fit. The local governments had almost across the board no recovery and no say in how those funds were spent. We see the opioid crisis very, very different. We believe that while states do have losses and do have some damages, we feel that the vast majority of the damages that are suffered by governments is by the local governments. They're the ones that have to deal with the jails that are overcrowded. They're the ones who have to deal with the addicts that have nowhere to go to get help. They're the ones that are running out of beds in their treatment centers and need to build more treatment centers. They're the ones dealing with the unemployment issues when people can't pass a drug test because everybody's become addicted to these drugs. So we very much feel that it's a local governmental issue. And at this point in the game, there's so many. There's about 12 to 1,400 cases right now in Cleveland. Vast majority of those are local governments. They're going to have a very, very prominent role in how this case plays out.
Okay, so ultimately what will happen is there'll be a couple of cases that will be tried, probably, and those cases will establish a round figure in terms of a number, and that number is in relationship to the damages that specific town has suffered. We have 10,000 cases of addicts. We have an algorithm that suggests they're going to need X number of years of treatment, some Y number of years of like lifetime treatment. It also means that we have a Z number of kids that are going to be dealing with this stuff. And so you create that algorithm and that number. And so essentially at one point at the end of the process, the hope is that number is presented to McKesson by court and says, this is what you're responsible for. This is how it gets divvied out based upon how much damages people have suffered, individual plaintiffs have suffered. How much, and I get the idea of like the tobacco settlement, the money went to the state legislature, and if they had a deficit, they just used it to plug a hole in the deficit. If they had roads they hadn't repaired, they fixed those roads instead of doing stuff that is a direct result of tobacco in their state, maybe pay more for Medicaid or whatnot. In this instance, are there any safeguards or mechanisms to make sure that the money that comes in ultimately, if you prevail, will go to those specific types of programs locally that will serve addicts?
You know, one of the things that was fascinating to me was as I went around the country over the last year or so and talked to different cities and counties about this litigation and tried to educate them on it and so they could make a determination as to whether or not they wanted to participate. One thing that I heard over and over again was exactly that. How can we ensure that any funds recovered from this litigation are used to properly address the crisis? I don't know how that's going to work out. I think we're too early in the game to verify that for sure. But as we've always talked about this, we want to see funds go into three areas. First, education. We think it's super important to get into the school systems, educate the kids that the pills in the cupboard are just as dangerous as a heroin needle. And if a needle goes on their arm one time, it's not going to be the last. Second, law enforcement and jailing. I mean, this is not a problem that law enforcement can solve, but it's a problem that they need resources to get through this scourge of addiction and addiction-related crime that's occurring in all these communities. And then third, and most importantly, is substance abuse treatment. We have to have a way to treat these people that have become addicted because of the bad conduct of these companies.
Jeff Gaddy, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. And we're going to have someone else sitting down in a moment to talk to us about a wage case, apparently that is in Ohio. But the opioid stuff is going to be interesting to watch, and they have expanded the playing field, I guess. Here we go. Yes, Steve? Okay, have a seat. Okay. Oh, hi. We're live right here. Okay. So sitting down with me is Steve Babin. You're with which firm? Okay, could you... Oh, hold on 1 second. Sorry. Say again.
Chapin Legal Group.
Okay, and Steve Babin from the Chapin Legal Group. And Steve, you're working on a... an interesting case that has to do with wage. Tell us what it's about.
Yeah, it's a case where we have sued 30 strip clubs in Ohio for illegal pay violations and civil conspiracy and antitrust violations. It's pretty simple. Essentially, what happens in a strip club is strip clubs either treat dancers as independent contractors or as what they call them in Ohio, tenants. And that's just a way to get away from having to pay them any wages at all. They have to pay a number of fees that are illegal. They got to pay to come in and dance. It's called a house fee or a dance fee. They got to pay a percentage of any individual dance that they do for a client to the club. They have to tip out to the DJ, the bartender, the bouncer, the manager. And by the end of the night, they end up with very little cash in hand.
I mean, let's face it. In the context of a strip club, they're doing the work that is bringing people into the establishment, right? I mean, they're the reason why people are there, and they're getting screwed in terms of their payment.
That's absolutely right. They're bringing in the business. There's no doubt about that. That's why people go to strip clubs, is to see the dancers. And, you know, in Ohio, it's an antitrust claim. So the antitrust laws basically say you can't unfairly restrict the free market. And with a strip club organization, what you have is you have a Club A that says, look, we're going to pay everyone zero wages. And that doesn't make sense unless all the clubs join together and agree to do it. If you have Club B that's paying wages and giving them extra money, well, then all the girls are going to go dance at Club B, and Club B is going to make all the money. So these guys have agreed to fix the wages, and they do it through a strip club trade organization in Ohio. There's one main organization. It's their trade organization, and they audit the clubs to make sure that they're in compliance with not paying the girls any wages at all.
So wait a second. So how does that work? I mean, they all agree to be members of this consortium, and then the consortium goes around and just makes sure that, like, nobody is paying a fair wage to their workers?
That's essentially it, yeah. They audit other things, and they also maintain a blacklist for any of the young women that want to stand up and maybe ask to, you know, get the same rights that you and I would get under the law.
Has there been any attempt to unionize on behalf of these dancers?
That's interesting. I have a client. We have our Our case is Ohio-based. One of our clients is in Chicago, and she's working in Chicago now, and she has a website. I think it's a stripper labor union rights, and she has tried. So there's been some attempt. The reality of the situation is this is a group of individuals that have very little bargaining power whatsoever, right? And the strip club pay scheme itself and the culture in which it creates is a system in which the dancers are told they're worth less than the other people's lives, right? Their lives are worth less than other lives. If they were to ask to get protections under the law that you and I would ask for, well, that's probably not going to happen for them. So I think that the culture just within the strip club industry itself is such that the dancers are afraid.
So how did this case come about? How did you get this case?
So there have been a lot of individual, what we call wage and hour cases across the country against one strip club in California, in New York, in Florida, and some of the bigger states. And in Ohio, I had brought a couple, and in investigating those cases and after filing them, found that we had a specific trade organization that that everybody joined up and said, let's make sure we do this together and implement this policy together so that we can take advantage of keeping the money in our pocket and not in their pocket.
Do you need, in the context of, there's a couple of different actions here, if I understand it. There's an antitrust violation that you're contending is a state law, or is that federal?
It's federal law. It's the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Okay. And there are state versions of antitrust in some states. I don't know what
Ohio
it is.
Ohio has one, yeah.
Okay. So you could theoretically bring it under both those laws. And then, secondarily, you're also charging that they are misclassified as contractors and are not getting Social Security wages.
They're not getting any wages at all. So it's a claim under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and it's essentially a minimum wage claim. What we're claiming is that in a free market, these dancers would be paid at least minimum wage. And that's what the individual Fair Labor Standards Act cases argue, that you can't classify these young women as independent contractors. They're employees. There's no doubt about it. They're employees. You determine when they come into work. You determine what their schedule is as far as the times they come into work, the days they come into work, the amount they can charge for tips, the amount or for dances, the amount they can charge for drinks. And that makes them an employee. They're not an independent contractor. And if you have an employee, you got to pay them minimum wage at least, and they pay them zero.
Are there any other, laws or statutes or principles, the theories that you're suing on?
So we have Fair Labor Standards Act, the Ohio State equivalent, antitrust, the Ohio State equivalent, and then civil conspiracy.
And what is the civil conspiracy? Is that a sort of an extension of the antitrust issue?
It's essentially an extension of the antitrust issue. It also, I guess the antitrust issue also encompasses the blacklisting of dancers. So they maintained a blacklist. During these audits, if a club had hired a dancer that was on the blacklist, they basically would get a demerit, is my understanding.
Now, wouldn't that be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act, too? Or is it because they're not unionized, there's no...
That's a great question. I think it would be because they're not unionized, it's probably not a violation of the national...
It's worth looking into. But, all right, let me ask you this. In terms of antitrust, do you need to prove that it appears that there is a vehicle, but do you need to prove that there is a vehicle and that there has been a mutual expressed understanding that we're going to all treat our dancers in this way? Or do you just need to show that there's a de facto sort of situation where all the dancers are being treated that way?
I can prove either, but in our case we have, the first, which is a per se violation.
But you can prove either, but which one do you need, are both sufficient?
I think both are sufficient, but here we have a per se violation because there are essential elements of the conspiracy that the clubs have agreed to, and those elements are reflected in the contracts girls sign when they come in and dance. They zero wages. You're a tenant or an independent contractor. You have to pay a house fee. There are certain penalty fees if you come in late, if you don't wear the right clothes, things of that nature. And because all the contracts are the same, and they all discussed it in the trade organization, it's a per se contracted violation of antitrust laws.
How much, when you look at this, is like, how much is the cases you've seen like Uber implicate something like this in terms of like misclassification, or does it not?
Ask me again.
Uber and those type of like car driving services, how much are they, how much of what has been established in the context of those cases pertain to what you're doing, at least on the wage side?
Sure. I mean, the Uber case is helpful. You know, the Uber case is the same type of case. It's an independent contractor case under the Fair Labor Standards Act. I think Uber is a bit more complicated because so the Uber argument is that the Uber drivers they can make their own schedule, right? They can work whenever they want. And that's the strong argument in the Uber case. And the argument against that is, well, you know, the nature of your business is Uber drivers. That's it. That's the only business you have. So they're your employees, right? And the dancer context, well, we have both, right? That is what your business is about. It's about people coming to see your dancers. And you dictate their schedule.
Right.
So...
So what ends up being the remedy here? I mean, do you break up their cartel? Is there, would the government step in and say, like, we're going to monitor for the next 10 years that there's some type of disparity in the way that you pay, or that you all pay in a proper way? Or?
So I think the remedy, the first remedy is that you're going to get the dancers paid back minimum wage for every hour they worked 3 years back times two for liquidated damages. The injunctive relief or the remedy moving forward, we don't know yet. We don't know what the proper pay scheme is that the strip club industry wants to implement that won't violate the law. I think that they're going to have to get together and figure that out moving forward.
Who's your plaintiff? I mean, are they identifiable enough that they're suffering? I mean, I imagine if there's a blacklist, this is the type, whoever your plaintiff is, would be exactly the type of person who's on that blacklist.
Yeah, so we have a plaintiff that was blacklisted, and then we have plaintiffs that have danced at clubs and been paid no money. And the reality, too, is, you know, we're not in Las Vegas, we're in Ohio. And our strip clubs, I'm sure we have some nice ones, but we have some not so nice ones, too. And these dancers will leave with less than $100 in their pocket a lot of the time. So it's not even a livable wage at the end of the day. So that's really the other violation, is they're not making enough money to even live.
Where is the case now? And do you see this as a case that maybe, I mean, is this a problem unique to Ohio?
The case right now is in the Southern District of Ohio in front of Judge Marbley. It is... The pay system, I don't think, is unique to Ohio. The conspiracy component and the trade organization may be unique to Ohio. We know that our conspiracy claims consist of members of the Ohio Strip Club Trade Organization. I don't know what other states do. They may have similar trade organizations with similar policies as well.
So it's possible if you guys get a favorable outcome here, we're going to hear about this case taking place in Arkansas, in Tennessee, in Illinois.
I think it's possible.
Interesting.
It's possible.
And when will we have a notion of where this case is going to end up landing?
It's a fairly new case right now. I think it's going to take some time. It's going to take some time, probably a year before we really know what this case looks like, what the real facts are going to be, as far as is it a model that we can take state to state.
Are you looking for more plaintiffs at this point, or do you not need more plaintiffs? Just everybody in that class, you're able now to go forward with the case. You have enough plaintiffs, and in the event that you win, presumably the list of all the people that these strip clubs has that they've employed as dancers, they'll all get some type of notice saying, in the event that you win, you are due a settlement of X number of dollars.
That's right. So we don't need more plaintiffs. I think we have a good number of, you know, what we call representative or named plaintiffs, and those are young women that are going to participate actively in the lawsuit. And then when we get a list, we'll send them out notice and tell them your rights have been violated. You're entitled to hopefully a settlement figure of X amount of dollars.
Well, good for you guys. Certainly people who work in any type of sex industry-related jobs have very little leverage, it feels like, and are easily taken advantage of, it seems. All right, what firm are you from again? I'm sorry, Steve.
Chapin Legal Group.
Chapin Legal Group.
That's right.
Steve Babin, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck, guys. Thank you. Sort of a fascinating case, and particularly in the context of how much we hear, there's been a renewed push to marginalize sex workers in the Stormy Daniels era, it seems to me.
I feel like after that I should say hell yeah in the absence of Jamie.
I was going to say, yeah, I am so bummed that she's not there.
Well, and also the activism against, and I'm forgetting the names right now, but was it the anti...
Sesta Fosta.
Well, we're going to be talking. Yeah. In fact, I think our next guest, they're doing some stuff on human trafficking here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure exactly what the take is. And our next guest, she's not going to be here for another 10 minutes or so. And so we'll do a little bit of sound. It appears I'm still trying to get my arms around where we are in the context of the Kavanaugh situation. But it appears, this is what I understand, is that the senators are looking at a report at a secure location today, because God forbid this information gets out, right?
Right.
To a Democratic people.
It hasn't been coming out all week already.
Right. And there's more now in the public record than there probably is in this report.
The people's report, definitely.
Right? Honestly,
there
someone should come out with a people's report. I'm going to go interview those other 40 people. But the idea is we have to keep it secret because we need to make it seem like it's real.
And we have to trust the FBI.
We need to. So it's either being kept secret to protect Kavanaugh, or it's either being secret to protect Kavanaugh. Here is Mitch McConnell on the floor of the Senate. He said this this morning. Is this right?
Last night.
Anticipating that people would see this report. Now, when you look back at the president going out and mocking Blasey Ford the other night, you got the sense that he thought the report was going to be limited enough that there would be an absence of more information that would implicate Kavanaugh, right? Because if you interview few enough people, then of course there will be an absence of new information. But here is Mitch McConnell.
And now senators will have the evidence collected by this additional background investigation for their consideration as well. Members will have the opportunity to review investigators' records, and as is the standard procedure designated, judiciary staff members with the required clearances will be authorized to brief members. There'll be plenty of time for members to review and be briefed on the supplemental material before a Friday cloture vote. So I'm filing cloture on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination this evening so the process can move forward, as I indicated earlier this week.
Okay, and so there's Mitch McConnell very somberly telling us that we've got to move forward the process. And Matt, if you can up my sound so I can hear that a little bit better next time.
That was, and the iPhone apparently was from that Senate chamber.
Yeah, well, it was from Mitch McConnell's pocket,
It was from Mitch McConnell's pocket. I have a question for you strategically, Sam. Do you think it was a mistake to hang so much on? I mean, it was very effective in the questioning when he wouldn't agree to an FBI investigation. Obviously, that along with everything else, like the constant lying, made him look terrible. But do you think it was a mistake to hang so much on that specific maneuver when you could, yes, you could just sort of turn in a limited FBI investigation in such a short period of time that didn't really yield anything? Was it a mistake for the Democrats to zero in on that so much or no?
I said at the time they needed to do two things. The FBI thing was super important to get people like Manchin and Flake and whatnot to make it about procedure, right?
Right.
I mean, we have been saying this since day one, that to get the first round of people you need to get, it has to be about procedure. It cannot be ideological.
Right.
And then you focus on Murkowski and Collins on more substantive issues. For Murkowski, it's, and by substantive issues, I mean issues that will impede their reelection.
Right.
Murkowski's very worried about Native indigenous people in Alaska who have issues with Kavanaugh for multiple reasons, not just over the sexual harassment claims, but other issues that it dealt with their land, I believe. And Collins, of course, it's Roe v. Wade. They should have, I think, in the questioning, they should have. They clearly had coordinated what they were doing in terms of the FBI, and I think that was good. That was the one that was effective. They also needed to hammer him on one specific lie to show that he's a liar.
Right.
And look, at the beginning of this, I also speculated that maybe, and it was one of those, you know, sort of, I will concede up front, you know, sort of wild speculations that who knows. But according to Ryan Grimm, it was not leaked from Dianne Feinstein's office that Kavanaugh existed. I mean, excuse me, that Ford, Blasey Ford existed. I suspect it was one of the lawyers that she met with around town, maybe. It's possible, or somewhere in that process. Mm-hmm. It could have been one of her friends who did it. But at the time, it also struck me as maybe not a bad thing for the Republicans to leak, because what could happen is what seems to have happened on some level, which is that an entire political party that certainly, I think, propelled Trump to victory. There were other aspects, but what was propelling Trump on his side, as opposed to what was depressing things on our side, was a sense of white male aggrievement. And this fit perfectly into that narrative. It's not so much that they're worried about the seat on the Supreme Court. It's just that, like, we cannot let the feminazis take out another white man, because if that happens, I could be next.
You're talking about the new polls coming out about, like, the enthusiasm gap narrowing?
Yep. And yeah. And you'll recall, right on the eve of the release, or at least the awareness of that letter, we saw polls that said they didn't see any stakes in this election. And, you know, people have to remember that, you know, the stakes, of course, are, from a political standpoint, you know, reversing Roe v. Wade for them. But in terms of what really lights their fire, it is this sense that, oh, my God, if this white guy doesn't become the great man he's destined to be, can I become the great man that I'm destined to be if I know that there's all these feminazis out there? And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing. And so I don't know if that goes away if Kavanaugh gets... I mean, the problem is that from the Republicans, from a strictly electoral side, if they vote Kavanaugh in, they lose that aggrievement. There's nothing worse for conservatives than to win in terms of politically. However, that is a huge price to pay for the left for decades. if they don't win this fight, it's going to be because Murkowski and Collins and Flake, or one of or two of those three, vote against him. And they'll try and do it on process grounds, but I don't know how they'll be able to
manage to do
that.
Well, Collins and Flake have both said they called the investigation thorough. So that, to me, I mean...
Yeah, that suggests that that is...
I think that's not looking good at all.
Right. So I guess we'll see.
You got your person there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a guest now. We will continue this conversation in a moment. Joining me now is Becca Timmons. Becca, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Becca, where and which firm are you with?
11 Papantonio in Pensacola, Florida.
Okay, so you guys, 11 Papantonio, starting to work on the question of human trafficking. What are you guys doing in that area?
Well, it's an emerging area. It's brand new, but we're looking at holding the instrumentalities and the tools that human traffickers use every day to carry out the criminal enterprise. I mean, they use the same things you and I use every day. They use hotels, airlines, they use the internet. And we think pursuing these platforms that host the content of either ads for human trafficking victims or using websites to solicit human trafficking victims, we think that there's a cause of action there.
Okay, let me ask you about this, because this has been of some controversy in our circles. SESTA and FOSTA.
That's correct.
I am of the perspective that there are problems with SESTA and FOSTA insofar as by preventing, I mean, aside from like free speech issues, right? Strictly looking on the specifics of this issue, that by preventing or holding liable Backpage for ads that are in Backpage prevents them from hosting these ads. And then it makes it that much harder for activists and entities that are trying to save people who have been human trafficked to track them down, that it goes into like darker corners, that unless you're a client in the past or you have some other connections, you wouldn't be able to find quite easily. And it makes it just harder. It pushes it into the shadows even more, makes it harder to identify who has been trafficked.
Right. And that has been suggested among many other issues. And FOSTA SESTA is going to endure its fair share of constitutional challenges, rightfully so. It's not perfect by any means. But there are a lot of activists for sex workers, for legitimate sex workers in the sex industry that, hey, you're putting us in danger. You're chasing us to back to the street corner where we're in can easily be threatened with violence. And the other argument has been that we're now chasing these internet ads into the dark web.
Right.
And that the recourse there and the tools we have are even more limited. But yeah, it's early. This has only been since April. And depending on who you ask, and some people will say, oh, look, we've eliminated all of these sex trafficking ads from the internet. Well, we don't really know yet. It's yet to be seen.
Well, it's great if you've gotten rid of the ads, but that's not the point, is it?
Right. The idea is that that's great. You get rid of the ads, you've made the problem worse. But again, we're not sure what the impact will actually be on it.
Okay. So how do you go about, you want to hold these platforms that make it possible for people to sex? So that could mean banks, right? I mean, theoretically, people are taking their money and putting it in banks, but the banks would have to have knowledge that that's where it's coming from. Like, so who are you targeting?
Well, I think probably the most attractive and probably the most effective thing to target would be these internet websites through FOSTA SESTA. And I mean, as we all know, prior to April of this year, you couldn't sue a internet service provider or a website for third-party content. And the Communications Decency Act, as we all know, Section 230, essentially created a safe harbor, saying that websites and ISPs aren't publishers, and that they essentially get a free pass under the First Amendment. But what FOSTA SESTA allows us to do now is to hold anyone who benefits from sex trafficking liable, anyone who knowingly benefits. So theoretically, you're right. You could sue every single inch of fiber optic cable saying that it facilitated human trafficking. But, you know, I think it's incumbent upon trial attorneys to use this wisely and, you know, not abuse it.
All right, but isn't that going to cause the problem that we were just talking about? I mean, these ISPs are not going to host these things, and all of a sudden it's just going to be out of sight,
right?
And maybe out of mind, but
right.
It's still going to be going on,
right? So now we have this censorship and this huge chilling effect,
right?
And now, like we said, we've driven it deeper underground, but I don't know if there's any evidence to suggest that's what's actually happening yet. It's only been on the books for 4 months. So, yeah, it's absolutely possible. But it's also possible that it's still going on the surface web right under our noses.
Okay, and so assume it's going on the surface web under our noses, and that's how you can sue people, right?
Right.
Its existence allows you to sue people. So, but where is, how does, what's the theory that this helps people who are being trafficked?
Well, there's lots of anecdotes of kids being sold on Backpage.com. And the theory is this, is that it's unquestionable human traffickers use these platforms. We don't, 100% of kids in sex trafficking are sold online. And just in 2008, the FBI found 3,000 instances of children being sold for sex on Craigslist. So if we can make a dent just in that, I mean, that's 8,000 kids. Or you're not going to get it all in one fell swoop. It's going to be a piecemeal attack on this criminal enterprise. And we think that's a good place to start.
So you're convinced that by limiting their ability to communicate online, if you can do that, that will help the underlying issue.
Right. I mean, unquestionably, the internet is the biggest tool for them, whether it's luring victims or selling them.
Are you going to, but I guess that becomes the question. I feel like maybe we're going around a little bit in circles. Like,
maybe.
Are you going to be able to do that? Like, it's one thing for you to be able to, like, quash Craigslist, to bang Craigslist on this, or to bang the back page, but what's to stop, like, I don't know, somebody setting up an exchange for a month?
Right. I mean, but.
And then just disappearing and
right.
not being an entity anymore.
So we got to try. We got to try.
But is there no other mechanisms that can do this? Like, I mean, following through as to traffickers and finding out, like, what airlines are actually, like, flying people? Like, what regulations do they have to make sure that they're not transporting?
Well, there is a civil mechanism for victims of human traffickers to sue anyone who facilitated their victimization. So there are other mechanisms outside of the internet. But the face of human trafficking and the way human trafficking works now has changed, just like with any business. So, like I said before, it's not so much that kids are getting snapped up or people are getting snapped up on street corners and then put up for sale, or that people are being moved in caravans and on, you know, across state lines. This is the front lines are on the internet, and they are. And we figure that it's the most visible, it's the most pervasive form that human traffickers use.
And so this litigation is coming out of exclusively of the passing of SESTA and FOSTA.
It would be the first of its kind. And there have been other lawsuits that human trafficking victims have sued, you know, truck stops under the other common law, civil, or not common law, but statutory recovery using other statutes. But, yeah, to my knowledge, no one has used FOSTA, SESTA in a human trafficking action.
Who is your plaintiff in this case?
Oh, man, that's the difficult part. How do we get human trafficking victims to come forward and relive their pain? And how do we not exploit them again? How do we say we're gonna use you and make a lot of money, and we're gonna send a big message, hope you don't mind? So I think this is something where plaintiff's attorneys are gonna have to really step back and handle this with a lot of sensitivity.
So there's not litigation right now. You guys are still trying to figure this out.
We're trying to figure this out. This is
because
cutting edge.
It seems
edge.
To me, like, I don't know how you get folks who are sex trafficked to come forward. I guess maybe you could find some people who somehow escaped that life in some
right.
fashion. But then I'm not clear how you get the money, the damages, to the people who are suffering from this.
There is a statute that allows for recovery for monetary damages for anyone who facilitated human trafficking. But you're right, you can't put up a bus stop or an ad on a park or on a bench and say, hey, if you've been human trafficked, give us a call. That's not appropriate. That's not how we're going to do
it.
And
isn't it the case that a lot of those people don't quite know that they would qualify as someone who's been human trafficked?
Oh, certainly. And a lot of them haven't even escaped it.
They perceive themselves as, I'm just here and I came to this country. I had no money and now this guy's making me do this. Like, they wouldn't necessarily even, you know, perceive that they've been sex trafficked as much as maybe they...
I mean, that's a possibility. That is a possibility. And we think, you know, if we just raise a little bit of awareness and we say, hey, this is what's going on and, hey, this is wrong, and that you're being a victim and you don't have to do this, then we've succeeded.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm curious to see where this goes. And Becca Timmons, I appreciate you coming in
Thanks
and talking
for
to
me.
Us about it. Please update us. I'll be here again. I'm curious to see where this goes.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks, Becca. So there it is. That is pretty nascent stuff, and I'm not quite sure how that pans out. I have a feeling Jamie would have liked our first guest, not so much the second one there.
Yeah,
she would have liked the first guest, not so much the second.
Well, in terms of what they said, they're both nice people.
She didn't
sure,
like either of them personally, actually.
All right, let's get back to what's going on with Kavanaugh here. So the dynamic is that, politically speaking, the Republicans are pretty happy. They feel like they have energized the the lizard brains of their followers by showing the aggrievement that Kavanaugh has suffered. I don't know that we have any more sound on that, do we? Or
we got Raj Shah saying like they didn't look into the drinking stuff.
Yeah, let's take a look at this, because it's not just that they didn't look into the drinking stuff. I mean, there's no way to say that they did any type of comprehensive, never mind investigation or even inquiry. They spoke to four people.
Literally
there
four
are
people.
People who are clamoring to give information about this. And now, I guess we're going to find out what Squee says, and Squee is a pretty important person in this. They spoke to Mark Judge. They spoke to PJ. And my understanding is they also spoke to Ramirez. Is that right?
Oh, that's my understanding, yeah.
Now, I don't know why you speak to Ramirez without speaking to anybody who could corroborate what Ramirez says. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. That sounds to me like they are, well, the only thing that you could give was uncorroborated information. That's true, because you didn't interview anybody who wanted to corroborate what she was saying.
They probably put a Jack Bauer type of guy on that could read a mind or something.
Jack Bauer can read minds? I didn't realize that.
That's a real problem.
Well, I think they knew it would be a huge problem if they were to open up all of Yale, because people are coming out of the woodwork there now.
Yeah. I mean, this is the time. This is the time parameters issue, which is like, in order to actually do this, you're going to actually need some time to do it.
Well, I definitely think they could have done it. They didn't need 4 days to do four interviews, right? I mean,
right.
I go to a conference and I interview 15, 20 people, and there's only one of me. There's an unlimited supply of FBI agents who could theoretically, there's probably 80 FBI agents that you could send out on a Monday morning, and by Monday evening they could have interviewed everybody.
How many can you trust not to be deep state, though?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. Here is Raj Shah on CNN.
He's deputy
saying,
press secretary.
Yeah, saying that, you know, well, whatever.
We want to know about the memory lapses. The friends who have come forward said that they know that he had memory lapses, and he said that he didn't. And that's relevant because Christine Blasey Ford has a story of him being staggeringly drunk, and maybe he doesn't remember it.
Well, they're not actually claiming direct evidence of memory lapses. They're saying they don't necessarily believe his testimony.
No, no. They're saying that they know. Hold on, let me just give you the real information. They're saying they were his roommate in college. They knew him in high school. They were his drinking buddy. You're talking about Jamie Roche's interview, right? Chad Luddington, and I'm talking about a woman at Yale who drank with him all the time, who says that they know that he had memory lapses because he couldn't remember the times that he spent with them.
Three individuals, I guess that you're referring to, have claims about what he said or didn't do while in college. That is not what the Senate is interested in or asking about. Again, he's gone through six FBI background investigations. All these types of questions get thoroughly investigated throughout one's career. He's been entrusted with some of the most important jobs in government over the last 25 years with a very high-profile career. Yeah. And all the folks that are demanding this type of an investigation in the Senate are Democrats who've already pledged to vote no. They don't want additional information to make a decision. They want to delay this process. Well, but
all they do is shift the goalposts. It's amazing.
Right.
It's amazing. I mean, within the span of seconds, he's shifting the goalposts there. First of all, we're going to blow off all of the evidence in real time outside of the investigation that the guy lied constantly about his drinking. And then it flips at the end to, yeah, but this is all old news anyways. The stuff that he lied about we don't want to fully investigate is old anyways.
Well, the bit about how he's been investigated multiple times for his previous jobs, why do we even investigate them after those in the first place then? Why even go past the first one? Why not just have one master investigation
that happens for your first clearance
job? Well, and let me tell you something about the nature of those investigations. They are all limited in their scope to speaking to people that he has worked with professionally at that time.
Yeah, maybe like they look at some academic transcripts and some tax returns or something. It's not like some big forensic investigation.
And, you know, the issue with someone sitting on the Supreme Court, the stakes are obviously much larger. And, you know, there was no... This is a guy who harbors the belief that the Clintons are out to get him. And this is payback. And that just seems like not exactly the temperament you want someone to have as a judge on the Supreme Court. But again, all this stuff that we're talking about is there's just a certain amount of kabuki about it, right?
Do you think that has to do with the impending investigation that's going to happen if Democrats take the House then? That they're trying to be so careful with what they... the parameters of this investigation as they've given it to the FBI.
So that when more stuff comes out, they're like, oh, we didn't know about this.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Look, the game for Collins and Murkowski maybe flake to the extent that he wants to, I don't know.
Brand himself.
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't... It's hard for me to think the way that these people think because it's just... sort of demented. But the game for Murkowski and Collins is plausible deniability. Right? They have to be able to say at one point, we just had no idea. We had no idea that there was this stuff was there and the FBI gave them an all clear, so we were good. But I guess we will see. And if Collins is saying that she thinks it's complete, then in some respects that she has to abide by it, right? That is the big tell.
It's thorough. And yeah, I mean, I mean, maybe the last move with her is to just say, you know, this guy is going to gut Roe v. Wade. And we all know this. You know this. And if, you know, but I mean, she's already closed the door on that, too. She said a couple weeks ago that, you know, what did he say? He said something that reassured her. I forget what the terminology was. But
it's got to come down to, again, that process. The FBI process was a
well, shame. If that's what it comes down to, it looks terrible from what she said. And I cannot imagine that. Manchin, Bucks, Flake, and Collins, and you know,
Heitkamp. Heitkamp is Well, you know, well, I sent that to you the other day, Matt. Like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, she's like, it's like 40 to 50. She's losing to Kramer now.
Well, my one wondering with Heidkamp is if Heidkamp is definitely going to lose, then maybe this is an opportunity for her to say, why don't I vote against this guy on the way out? I mean, the very least she could do that.
I don't know that she's that principled.
That's not the way that works.
I don't know anything about her.
That's you've watched too many. You've watched Bulworth too many times. All right, let's.
What's Bulworth?
What's Bulworth?
I don't watch Bulworth, dude. What's that movie?
It was. What's his face? I can't remember the actor's name. Famous.
Warren Beatty.
Famous actor. Warren Beatty, when he was the politician who had cancer.
Wait, and so the guy who raps?
Yeah.
Wait a second. You think that Heidi Heidkamp saying, I'm down double digits, I might as well vote against this guy I don't like and have a in with Democratic constituencies in the future is the equivalent of her starting to rap?
Well, it's not just rap. You should watch the whole movie.
Okay.
I mean, he took a principled stand because he thought he was on the way out.
All right.
And that's... All right.
Oliver Platt. Nice.
Might be a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah, Oliver Platt. It is worth watching the movie. Okay. Daniel Nye is joining me. We're going to be talking about Val Sartin.
Sam?
Here, hold on. Let me get you up here, Daniel. And what firm are you from, Daniel?
I'm with Levin Papantonio.
Levin Papantonio.
Yes.
And, okay, so Val Sartin, what is that? What is that drug?
Well, Valsartan is a very popular blood pressure medication. It's called an angioretention blocker. So right now there are currently 3 million people using Valsartan in the U.S. Very popular blood pressure medication.
And you'd get prescribed this for having high blood pressure?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
And so what is the controversy around Valsartan?
Well, this is the largest class 1 recall at, you know, most likely. We're still trying to validate the numbers, but it appears to be the largest class 1 recall ever.
Okay, what is a class 1 recall?
A class 1 recall is where the pharmacies and the insurance companies, they're required to send notice directly to the consumer, so directly to the people who've been affected by the contamination that's inside of the Valsartan. And that contamination is what's called NDMA. We call it dimethyl nitrosamine. So basically, N as in Nancy, not MDMA, which is ecstasy, but NDMA.
All right.
And basically, it's very toxic. It causes the WHO classifies it as a possible carcinogen, but the only reason they can only say possible is because you can't do human studies on it because it is so toxic that you wouldn't subject any humans to that kind of study.
So wait a second. So there is a drug that 3 million people take in this country.
That's right.
Has the recall happened yet?
It has.
It's been issued.
It has. And there's over 1.5 million people that we know that are subject to the recall already. And the list is going up and up. So the FDA continues to update the list of the different medications, the different U.S. manufacturers that had this contaminated Valsartan. You know, most of it comes from one Chinese plant in China where they were making the active ingredient that goes into the Valsartan. So they ship that active ingredient over here to the U.S. and they put it into pill form here in the U.S. That active ingredient is contaminated with NDMA.
And where did that contamination take? It took place in this Chinese factory.
That's right. Chinese factory. And, you know, what we've seen with a lot of these Chinese factories, and this one is no worse. It's called Weihai Chinese factory. And essentially what happened is when they're combining the molecules together to give us the active ingredient for Valsartan, if you combine those molecules in too acidic of an environment, you get these byproducts called NDMA, NDEA, and other nitrosamines. And that's exactly what we found in this pill. So, and it's a high concentration of it as well.
Is it jet fuel? Like, what's it? I heard that.
That's right. NDMA is commonly found in jet fuel. That's the main spot. So basically, people are ingesting a little bit of jet fuel in every time they take this pill of Valsartan.
How many times a day do they take this pill?
They'll take it one time a day. But these people have been taking this contaminated Valsartan. A lot of these, you know, clients of mine have been taking it for 4 years now.
How did they find out that this was contaminated?
That's a good question. We're still trying to find that out. But we don't know if the manufacturer actually came out and recognized that they had it inside of there, or if it was one of the agencies like the EMA. We think that maybe they got tipped off to it. It's the European Medical Agency. It's basically the equivalent of the FDA, but at Europe's agency.
Does the FDA test, like, okay, we have the most popular pill in the country for blood pressure. Does the FDA say, like, okay, good, every millionth pill that you send out, send one to us. Send us 100 pills, and we're just going to test it in our lab just to make sure that it's...
They don't do that at all. That would have caught the problem if they had done that in the last 4 years, but they don't do that. And now that they've been signaled to the problem...
Is there any process that we have that can find that a drug is, never mind like long-term implications of a drug is unhealthy, right? I mean, obviously that's
right.
That involves more complicated studies, but just as like, there's no lead in this. There's no, you know, there's no contaminants in this. We're just going to run like, you know, a half a dozen potential contaminants of every pill.
That's right.
Just, do we have any mechanism for that?
The FDA puts the onus on the manufacturer to do that testing. Then
and then
FDA,
what do? They send in documents to the FDA like,
that's
hey,
right.
Every quarter we test or every day.
Or the inspectors go to their manufacturing plant and they examine those test results. Now, what you will see with these manufacturing plants.
FDA inspectors or third-party inspectors?
The FDA inspectors.
Okay.
There are only 17 of them in all of China, and they're required to look at all these different manufacturing plants in China. So they'll usually only get about 30 minutes to an hour
There's
at these manufacturing plants.
There's 17 FDA inspectors.
There are.
In the entire country of China.
That's
how
right.
Much, how many of U.S. drugs are manufactured in China? Like what? Like
oh, 80% of the generic medications that we take here in the U.S., are manufactured in China.
So how many companies are we talking? How many factories do these 17 people have?
Numerous. I don't know the number, like, but they'll normally get one trip to factory. Maybe they get two or three, and they'll usually be there for a half hour, hours is our best estimate at this point. But what's interesting is even in that short amount of time, they catch these Chinese manufacturing companies manipulating data all the time.
So there's no restrictions by the Chinese government on these companies, is there?
Well, there are, but we don't think they're anywhere close to where they should be.
Why don't we say, you know what? You got to manufacture this stuff in America.
That's what we try to say, but we give a loophole, which is if you manufacture the active ingredient in China, you can then ship it over here and put it in a pill form in the U.S. So, that's their way around the loophole. I mean, they do the same thing with automobiles, all sorts of issues. As long as you put it together in the U.S., then you get around the loophole.
But we could say active ingredient must be developed in
absolutely
the United States.
Absolutely, we could.
All right, let's talk about the action that you're going to follow here. So you don't know why they initiated this recall. Ultimately, maybe you will find out in the context of discovery, right?
That's right. We know that they issued the recall because there's MDMA in the pill. We don't know who alerted the MDMA in the pill.
And that's relevant because it goes to when they knew.
Right.
And how they knew. Because theoretically, they should have been the ones who said, like, oh, my gosh, we have this.
Yes.
And fortunately, we've been so diligent in testing that we found out probably 2 weeks after the first pill was made with this stuff.
That's right. And I will say, in terms of litigation on these types of cases, this isn't a failure to warn case. This is strictly a manufacturing defect. You're strictly liable if you put cancer in your pill.
So it's they're going to be liable. It's just a question of how big the damages are based upon trying to figure out how long they've been doing this for.
That's right. And we also think that the U.S. manufacturers who put it into pill form are also liable for this because they're also required to do their own impurities testing.
Wow. So the system failed on multiple occasions.
Multiple occasions.
And then when you're getting, when you go in for damages, I mean, just tell me how it works here. You establish, like, is it a case closed? Is at least one part of the case closed on day one where it's like, yeah, there's poison in your pills.
That's right.
We don't know if one person took this or a million people took
it. That's right.
Or 2 million.
Yeah.
And we don't know if they took it for one day or they took it for 4 years.
Well, we're pretty confident that there are about 1.5 million people who have taken this pill for years. Okay. And so we've already established that have taken contaminated NDMA. We feel pretty confident in that. The next part of it is, what does NDMA cost? And so what we've looked at, we've done a deep dive into the animal studies. And also there are some other studies where people are exposed to NDMA. And we believe that the strongest cases are if you've got liver cancer, if you got colorectal cancer, or if you got stomach cancer after ingesting this MDMA for, you know, a few years, you probably have a good case that MDMA caused your cancer.
Okay, so most of the work that you're doing is going to be epidemiological, trying to establish just how big the damages are, not whether or not there's a claim for damages.
That's right.
Okay.
And this is also one of those scenarios. We don't know yet whether or not this is purely an increased risk. So we basically, there are many other things that can cause cancer. So there's this background rate. So we're not going to know whether or not this early in the litigation, whether this is an increased risk kind of case. So you took the NDMA and it gave you a 50% extra chance of getting cancer. Or if we can actually see something in the cellular process itself, you know, like NDMA in the cell. And then, you know, be pretty crystal clear that it's the NDMA. Okay.
So, two things. One, is part of the damage is a function of, like, you need to, in the future, change your procedures to XYZ as either a stopgap to what obviously was a potential failure to execute, or as a better plan because your plan, even though it was well executed, didn't work.
Well, we actually think the Chinese manufacturer is very culpable in this case. I think it's, you know, from some of the early returns that we've seen in documents, can't talk about them yet, but I believe that the Chinese manufacturer is very culpable. I wouldn't be surprised that they knew about this problem as far back as 2016 and buried the results.
Okay, so the Chinese manufacturer buries the results, but then down the line, there's supposedly other mechanisms that the people who are putting these pills together should have caught that.
That's right.
So what kind of safeguards comes from, does the manufacturer just develop them on their own? Or can that be something that's part of the damages?
Well, the FDA has given them guidance as to the types of impurities testings that they're supposed to do. But again, this is a strict liability. You put cancer in your pill,
right?
You're liable for it.
I'm just interested on the other end of this.
That's right.
Obviously, a lot of people are going to get a lot of money because of they may either have like a ticking time bomb in terms of cancer, or they already may have cancer as a function of this. But for the next manufacturer of the next pill, what safeguards have been put in place that have increased or decreased the likelihood something like this could happen?
The FDA has all along given guidance for how you're supposed to test impurities in these pills. And they did come up with an update in March of 2018 that had that been followed, we feel very confident that it would have been detected in March of 2018. But we also think that if you'd followed the guidance that the FDA gave earlier than that, it would have been detected. We also believe that we have some information that some of the U.S. manufacturers, or at least one of them, had detected this impurity early on.
Jesus.
But we're still trying to confirm that information.
And do those entities that knew about it, like, are damages against them, is there like treble damages for something like that? Like, to knowingly do that? I mean, shouldn't there should be criminal charges for that?
Absolutely. Now, I don't know that we'll get as far as criminal charges, but there should be. But the way in which we punish that in the civil system, as you know, punitive damages, and that will absolutely be a part of this case.
Have there ever been instances where you actually like have enough evidence that like there was one individual who just, you know, was careless enough to write an email like, yeah, I know it's jet fuel. I'm speaking hypothetically. I know it's jet fuel in the baby formula that we're given, but it's just going to cost too much to take it out. So a couple of babies may get ill. They'll be okay. You know,
as a drug product liability lawyer, I see the internal documents for many of these cases. A lot of times they're confidential, so we can't release them to the public. But I can tell you there are numerous corporations where we see that very document that sort of business decision where they put profits over safety, where there is an easy correction to it, but they looked at it and they said, that's going to cost us more money. We'll just pay the dying widows or the widows, or we'll just pay the damages of the lawsuits because that's going to cost us less money than to actually fix the problem and avoid the injury to these people in the first place.
Can you ever put out documents like that redacted in a way, like so that you wouldn't know what the product was and who said it? I mean, just to see the words, I feel like.
There are some litigations where we get to see that information.
Where
so every now and then you get into a trial, that information comes out, and the judge unseals it. So then we can actually see that information for some of the litigations. Like, as I mentioned, one of those would be the Ford Pinto back in the day.
Right. But there's no other way to get. I mean, I just feel like the public, if they had a notion of just how, I mean, evil those people can be. And then, but why in that instance, like, okay, you've seen the documents. It's supposed to be private. You've either settled or the court has sealed this stuff. But why should that protect someone from some type of criminal liability? Because that to me sounds like manslaughter at best.
Right. I mean, all the time. I mean, that's all the time we deal with that problem here in the U.S. system. We rarely see criminal charges for what I believe is criminal conduct.
But I don't understand how that stuff is kept private within the context of that if it is evidence of a crime. Like, I can't.
Right.
I mean, what? How is that? Where's the reform for that? I mean, I know I'm howling at the moon a little bit here, but.
Well, I mean, I can just tell you, as a lawyer in my area of litigation, you're probably going a little bit past my area of expertise, but I can tell you, when we start off a litigation, we want to be able to get those documents instead of having a prolonged fight as to what's confidential and what's not. So we usually give the agreement, you produce the documents to us, we'll keep them confidential. That's how it starts out. So that's about as far as I can go, other than when we get to trial, then a lot of times those documents become unsealed, right, and the documents used at a trial can become public at that time.
And I suppose, theoretically, if there was a statute that said, there's no such thing as confidentiality.
Right.
Dan and I can say we'll keep it confidential, but statutorily, if there's any evidence of a crime, Dan Nye is liable if he doesn't release it.
Sure.
And then you guys won't see those documents going forward.
Oh, yeah. We would obviously have to release it, but then we would have that issue in the first place. Would we ever even get those documents?
So where can people hear more about the status of this? The drug is out.
Where can people hear more about the status of this?
Yeah.
Well, I would. You can obviously see it on our webpage, levinlaw.com. That's levinlaw.com. And we'll keep it updated.
Has this been in the press?
Oh, yes, absolutely. CNN's been reporting on it.
Zolastrin.
And many other Ring of Fire reports on it all the time.
So if I've taken Zolastrin for a year, what do I do right now?
Well, Valsartan.
Valsartan, excuse me.
Yeah, Valsartan. And if you've been taking it for a year, I highly urge you to go see your pharmacist. It's possible that you have the contaminated NDMA in your Valsartan, but you don't know about it. So sometimes the notice doesn't get to all the consumers.
So go
to your pharmacist, talk to him about it.
Get a different prescription.
Well, see if it's even the contaminated Valsartan, because there is some uncontaminated Valsartan, then you're likely safe. But if it's the contaminated Valsartan, they're either going to likely give you an uncontaminated Valsartan if there's enough of it in supply, which there's been a shortage, or they're going to give you a drug in the same class.
Okay. And then eventually you'll hear from folks if you had some of that contaminant. But do you go to your doctor at that point and say, hey, I've been taking this stuff?
Well, you can go to your doctor as well, but the pharmacist is going to be the main person who's going to know.
You switch it out with the pharmacist and you find out you've been taking it. But once, if you find out that, like, I've been ingesting jet fuel, like, are there recommended steps for you to take to, like,
sure,
maybe you should get some cancer screenings?
That's right. Well, we don't know what the incident is at this point. You've been taking NDMA for 4 years, the FDA came out and said 1 in 8,000 people would get cancer. That was their first estimation. We think that might be a very conservative estimate. But we don't know if it's going to be 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000. But I absolutely think it's wise to go to your family doctor at the very least and tell them, I've been taking the contaminated Valsartan. I just want to do a checkup to make sure I don't have a cancer.
All right. Well, Dan Nye, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks. Wow. always nice to hear about those cases where you have drug executives who are like, eh.
Single type of executive.
We should do a compilation of that question of, have you ever seen the thing where they just decided to make
Feel like over the past 6 years, I've asked that question to a lot of lawyers, and they've all been like, you can't believe what I've seen.
They almost never let you finish asking the question.
I think dozens. We've heard some variation on that with guns, drugs, cars. Even like the McDonald's coffee case. Remember that debunking about that everybody, that was like the world's number one frivolous lawsuit?
Yeah, hot coffee.
And we actually did it. Yeah, and then you actually went into it. It was like, no, this was actually catastrophically dangerous and reckless by the McDonald's Corporation. And they seriously harmed somebody.
Oh, yeah. She had scarring all over her her crotch. She was an older woman.
Right.
She just...
Right.
And wanted barely nothing from them. But apparently it was a practice by McDonald's to keep the coffee that hot because it saved them some money by having to reheat it. It meant that they could pre-pour it, you know, and maintain it on the shelf for, you know, 130 seconds, which is going to save us every day across the country $6,000 or some fucking, excuse me.
Sam in Vegas mode, dressed like a G-man, talking like a sailor.
Yeah.
It was fucking nonsense.
Absolute nonsense.
I have to say, it's capitalism.
But, you know, the thing is that I guess it is.
It is.
I mean, I guess it's just that it is, there's a certain inevitability, I guess, in the sense that if you're going to set up a system this way that rewards greed, you know, how do you find that limiting principle? Right? Because like every calculation that these guys make is we're going to maximize profits. And that's the only thing that's important.
Well, that's like the Koch brothers market-based management, right? It's like how to save money on pipeline monitoring.
Yeah, it's everything. And it's like, you know, I did an interview that we're going to play tomorrow with a guy named Mike Berg, who's handling the cases of those gas lines that blew up in Massachusetts.
Jesus.
Hey, you know, it's a classic case of like, wow, we got a real problem with these pipes. All right, well, let's just wait on it.
Right.
Because if we spend the money now, preventatively, all we're going to do is cut into shareholders.
Right.
How much money they make. And so let's just wait until it's, you know, a problem. I mean,
they even have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder profits pretty much at the expense of literally everything else. I mean, nothing surprising about it.
I mean, if you have a roof, right, on your house, and it's a 25-year roof when you bought it, and you're 25 years out, everybody knows that what you're going to do is like, well, just because it says it's a 25-year roof doesn't mean that I got to switch it now. I mean, I'm going to wait until it becomes a real problem, and then I'll fix it. Like, you know, if a couple of shingles start falling off, and then I know it's a real problem, then I'll fix it.
But, couple of people's houses blow up in,
right. The problem
in
is
Falmouth.
The stakes,
we know it's a real problem.
Right. The stakes are slightly different. Jesus. And you're, you know, unbelievable.
I don't know. Do you have more guests coming?
No, I don't. So let's dig into some of the sound. I mean, maybe we could go into the fun half. Now we might as well.
Okay.
So we're going to go into the fun half. We'll take some phone calls. We'll play some more sound. Keep an eye on me at via the app.
Do you have the IM on your end?
I do.
Okay.
I should tell folks right now that we're still, you know, working on the. I think the iOS app is almost done. We had some problems with those son of a guns at Apple. They love to make money. And so they did not
love money.
they basically said, like, you have to give us a way of making money with your app.
Money.
And I was like, come on. Aren't you guys making enough money? Can't you just let us have our app? But no. So
we're building them
something.
A mini tax haven.
Exactly.
Just to contribute to the overall haul so that everybody plays their part in helping Apple.
It's funny to think of Apple's power in this position and then think people think the free market is something that exists.
What's that?
Like the Apple right. can just decide whether we can have a become a member button on the app, and then we act as if a free market actually exists.
Well you could just not use Apple.
Well, but this is a perfect example of an antitrust problem. Because when you have market concentration like this, I'd have to work out that
it's definitely
dynamic.
A form of monopoly. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, and they own the playing field, and so you got to give them a cut. And they could say, "Oh, you could just do it on Google." But yes, but the problem is that you guys have been so successful that you've now cornered the market. Now, they of course didn't get their success exclusively without any type of government or societal help.
Like cheap
but
labor?
But even if cheap labor, there's stories
illegally
of
mined minerals from Congo.
Yes, immigrants apparently putting together stuff early on in Silicon Valley, which I recently read about. But the bottom line is that's why we have antitrust laws. That's why society has decided you shouldn't have the ability to control markets and our politics because of your size. Now, of course, they also hid money off overseas,
Ireland,
and raised their cash. So, I mean, screw them. But they are, for the meantime, they're screwing us. So that's what that is.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. I will be back. For those of you, we're going to the fun half. For those of you on the free show, we'll be back tomorrow with a similar program. David Pacman is here in Vegas, and I'll sit down with him to talk a little bit about politics, too. 646-257-3920 is the number. And, Michael, you'll call in there, and I'll look at the...
Okay.
All right. See you soon.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are...